Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Auto insurance, it goes hand in hand with a driver's license if you actually want to use it, and California is home to some 27 million licensed drivers. But lately, it's become increasingly difficult to lock down affordable car insurance here, in a state where over 130 companies offer it. From double-digit rate hikes to weeks-long waiting periods, these issues have generated a lot of complaints from consumers, and it's bubbled up to a response from the top. The complaints have gotten so numerous that California's insurance commissioner recently warned insurers to follow the law and said that their alleged actions will not be tolerated. So, how'd we get here? And what options do drivers have if they're struggling to get insured? Levi Sumagaisai is an economy reporter with the nonprofit newsroom Cal Matters, which is a content sharing partner with public radio stations across the state. And she joins us to shed more light on the current car insurance landscape here in California. Good morning, Levi.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
So I have been familiar with home insurance, particularly fire insurance in California, and how it's become increasingly difficult in recent years. Auto insurance is kind of new for me. So give us a little bit of a background. When and why did auto insurance become more expensive and more difficult to find?
Sure. So during the pandemic, as you know, Californians were on lockdown and we were not driving our cars. Around then, the Department of Insurance basically stopped approving rate increases from auto insurers. And for about 2 years, the Department of Insurance barely approved any rate increases. And starting last year or so, auto insurers began to request rate increases. And the Department of Insurance is now approving them because we are back to driving around. So auto insurers say, one, that pause hurt them, and two, that their costs are rising, that when they have claims, that it is more expensive to replace car parts, that labor costs more. And so that's what they're saying to justify the rate increases that they've requested.
So now when it comes to drivers now, you know, years after or a few years after, you know, the state shut down, a driver wants to get auto insurance. What are they encountering today when they're shopping around?
Sure. So a lot of auto insurers have instituted new waiting periods. They range from like 10 days to 30 days. Some of them have stopped accepting applications online, are requiring drivers to, they're mailing applications to drivers, are requiring drivers to mail them back, are saying, you are going to get our decision by mail. So, you know, in this day and age when we are so used to instant gratification, being able to, you know, get all kinds of things online, this very important thing that we all need there are just delays associated with it. So that's one thing. Another thing that drivers have told me or that I've heard about that they've encountered is they're being asked to pay their premiums all up front as opposed to monthly. If you're a new driver or if you happen to have a not so stellar driving record, it's going to be really hard for you to get insurance right now. And if you do, when you finally do get it, it'll probably be more expensive than you think it's going to be.
Going back to having to mail things, you know, I remember when I applied for auto insurance. I mean, this was years ago. I was able to do it on my phone and get a quote, and I was able to shop around pretty easily from my couch. You know, what do you think the motivation is to kind of go back to an antiquated way of dealing with drivers and insurance companies?
Right. Well, you know, consumer advocates are sort of slamming insurers for these new practices. They're saying that these are stalling tactics, that insurers, you know, which are required to provide quotes and insurance to good drivers in California under the law, that insurers are doing what they can to stall and delay because they're maybe waiting for the Department of Insurance to approve the rate increases, or that, you know, they don't want to insure what, you know, who they think are more risky drivers. And so, you know, those kinds of things are happening. And it's not just the consumer advocates who are complaining about these tactics. The Department of Insurance, the commissioner, Ricardo Lara, recently, like you said earlier, warned insurers that, you know, that they need to get approval before they make changes to their policies from the Department of Insurance, because that's what California law says.
You also mentioned that, you know, if you don't have a good record, you know, if you, it's going to be harder to find insurance. If you do find it, likely you're going to have to pay higher premiums. And they're also, you know, making some changes, like you got to pay it all up front as opposed to monthly. Are there other factors that are contributing to an increased premium for drivers?
Well, you know, the insurers are saying that their costs have gone up. And, you know, from my reporting, both on the auto insurance issues that we're having in California, as well as the fire and home insurance issues, you know, it appears that insurers, not just in California, but across the country, are saying that they just have increased costs, and that climate change, you know, is also an additional risk to them. And, you know, some of these auto insurers are also home insurers. And so they're just saying that they, especially in California, might not have the reserves that they need in order to offer insurance. They're a lot, you know, their reasons sort of run the gamut.
Yeah. I mean, in recent years, we obviously have inflation, cost of living, healthcare costs have gone up, as well as supply chain issues. And that all trickles down if something happens to your vehicle, or if you need to go to the hospital because you were in an accident and the insurance is supposed to cover that. When it comes to our state, I mean, we have had trouble with insurance companies even recently. Like, some insurance companies, when it comes to like home insurance, have pulled out of the state. That was last year. So when it comes to auto insurance, are these increases and challenges, is it unique to California? Or how does it compare to other states?
Sure. So insurers very much say that California regulations are to blame. So there is a law called there's Prop 103 regulates insurance in California. Among other things, it requires insurers to get approval from the Department of Insurance before they can raise rates or really make, you know, make changes. And so insurers say that Prop 103 is very prohibitive to them. It has a cap. Like, if an insurer wants to raise its rates by more than 7%, they risk having a hearing attached to that. That is, if an intervener objects to a rate increase over 7%, they have the right to request a hearing. Oftentimes, what will happen, as I've found out, is that the intervener, which is usually Consumer Watchdog or some other consumer advocacy group, the intervener, the Department of Insurance, and the insurance company will talk among themselves and try to come to some sort of settlement. And then, you know, that'll avoid a hearing, which I've been told can last a year or two, you know, can take a really long time. And that's not that's not good for anybody, not for the Department of Insurance, not for the insurers that are trying to raise rates or make changes, and not for consumers, because it just, you know, it just takes away choice. So, you know, the difference between auto insurance and home and fire insurance right now is that under Prop 103, insurers that do business in California have to offer quotes, at least, and provide insurance to good drivers in California. That's just the law.
And what is considered a good driver in California? What are the metrics for that?
Yeah, so a good driver is someone who has, for the past 3 years, not had more than 1 point on their record, like an at-fault accident, you have to have some sort of driving record for the past 3 years.
Hmm.
And also under Prop 103, if you're considered a good driver in California, insurers are also supposed to offer you a discount.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, it is a requirement. You need to have auto insurance if you want to drive in California. It is a requirement. Given that, obviously, there's a lot of challenges and, you know, the reality is that rates are going up and that waiting periods have been extended. Is this just limited to, like, the big major insurance providers? Because we have over 100 in the state. Or is this affecting all insurance companies, regardless of size?
From my reporting, what the problems I've heard about have been mainly complaints against the big companies. When I talked to the Department of Insurance about these problems and asked, you know, what are they doing about it? Well, one thing that they do recommend is that, you know, if a driver can't get insurance through a big company that they keep trying, because there are over 100 companies that are doing business in California, and they're not going to stop. You know, California is the biggest market for drivers. They call insurance brokers who might have more access, who might be able to help them. And in one of the stories that I wrote for CalMatters, you know, that is what happened with one of the people I spoke with, is that, you know, he was trying to do it himself and he really didn't have any luck until he went with he got in touch with a broker who was able to then go ahead and secure insurance for him. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of hurdles. And as you mentioned, I mean, you started reporting on this, you know, at the beginning of December, about 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago. And then following your initial report, Ricardo Lara, the insurance commissioner of the state, he responded to these ongoing complaints and concerns from drivers, you know, warning of a possible crackdown, you know, threatening enforcement. I mean, realistically, what can the state do to penalize or to get insurance companies to, in their view, to comply?
Right. I mean, so, the bulletin that Lara, the insurance commissioner, issued is meant to be a deterrent, right? Like, it's supposed to warn insurers, hey, stop doing that. And in fact, in the press release announcing the possible crackdown, the insurance commissioner did say that some insurers have stopped, the tactics that people have been complaining about since the insurance commissioner said something. Also, I know that, Consumer Watchdog, which is a consumer advocacy group that's very active in this space, they as part of the intervener process, have secured promises from Allstate, actually, from Allstate for them to stop doing what they've been doing. It does have some teeth. The warnings do have some teeth. And if insurers continue to do this, then Lara says that, you know, they will take more formal enforcement action.
If you currently have auto insurance and maybe you just want to keep it, is there the potential, you know, now that you could get dropped from it or, you know, face higher premiums?
I think there is that potential. I've been, I've been lurking online following all kinds of complaints. People just have to be careful. People with new drivers in their households. I'm going to be one of those soon. Have to start early and have to do their research and really just shop around. And also another thing, you know, for drivers out there, I mean, one of the things that auto insurers have done since, you know, the lockdowns went away and we all have sort of shifted back to our normal driving patterns, is that some of them have automatically raised your insurance rate and, you know, said, okay, you're driving this many miles a year. Check your insurance stuff let your insurer know if you aren't driving as much as they think you are, because then that can help your rates.
Finally, in the last 30 seconds we have, someone's listening to this. I mean, it can be worrisome for sure. You know, what resources are out there? What advice do you have?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, if you're encountering difficulty, let the Department of Insurance know. I mean, they know about what's going on. That's obviously why LARA has issued the warning to insurers. Let the Department of Insurance know what you're going through. Also, the Department of Insurance website has resources on there. There's like, you know, comparison things you can do online. And also there are consumer advocacy groups that, you know, who are ready and willing to advocate on behalf of consumers.
Lovey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Levy Sumagaisai is CalMatters economy reporter talking about the difficulties in finding affordable car insurance in California. Up next, the window is now open for college financial aid applications, and the programs have seen a lot of new changes. We'll hear from experts about how to navigate the new financial aid system. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. If you're heading off to junior college, a four-year college, or already a student, much of what you thought you knew about financial aid is about to change. From timelines, deadlines, requirements, need-based aid, merit-based aid, and of course the Cal Grant program, there are a lot of new changes that are happening. And while it may seem overwhelming, and that is totally understandable, it's also very important information to maximize your financial aid as higher education becomes increasingly expensive. So we're going to make sure you understand some of the major changes that are happening for the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, as well as Cal Grant programs. With the window now open for financial aid applications and problems already reported with the new system, we have a few experts to help navigate some of the changes and the challenges. Jackie Navarez is the College and Career Coordinator for Sacramento City Unified School District. Melissa McClellan is the Director of College Counseling at Christian Brothers High School in Sacramento. And John Waldrop is with the California Student Aid Commission. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you. Good for morning.
Thank you.
As I said, it's like a financial aid party in here, so we have a lot of guests. You know, this takes me back like many moons ago when I was going to college. My parents didn't go to a four-year university, so when applying for financial aid, I just kind of felt like I was trying to make my way around a dark room. It's very, very confusing. I just want to start off with, like, what is it like now applying for financial aid for students and for families in each of your schools? Jackie, I'll start with you at Sac City Unified.
Well, so being a first gen, I too didn't have the, a knowledge base to be able to, you know, lean to my parents. So that's one of the reasons why I'm really passionate about making sure we're communicating that to all of our students. In Sac City Unified School District, we host Cash for Colleges at all of our comprehensive high schools, and we will have one for all of our small schools as well. And so that's one of the ways we're, you know, providing in-depth, you know, support for our families, as well as backwards mapping. There was legislation that went through in 2019 called AB 2015 that required all students to have financial aid awareness by 11th grade. And so that's something that we're really pronounced at doing in Sac City Unified School District.
Yeah. And as we know with Sac City Unified, it's an incredibly diverse school district. Yes. I think like over 40 languages yes. are spoken, like roughly 2/3 are on free or reduced lunch. You know, how does that impact your work in helping people navigate financial aid?
Well, so we are very cognizant as we're, you know, engaging with our families and students, you know, sharing this information in our ELAC meetings, making sure that we're sending out communications to all of our students and our families in multiple languages. Additionally, you know, at our Cash for College events, we'll have bilingual translators to support the completion of either the FAFSA or the California Dream Act application. And then, you know, most importantly, really just connecting with our students, helping to see, you know, them to see the future and, you know, recognize that they can, you know, be authoring their own book. And this is one of the very first chapters that they want to do is to complete these financial aid applications.
Yeah. And Melissa, so you help students navigate this at Christian Brothers in Sacramento. You know, what have been the biggest changes, you know, with the new changes that are coming with financial aid application for FAFSA or even Cal Grant?
I mean, some of the, you know, some of the biggest changes have to do definitely with this different timeline. It used to be in October when the FAFSA opened, and so it gave students and families a little bit more time to receive their financial aid packages from the universities and make an informed decision about what's going to be the right move for the family financially. And moving it to, you know, opening late January, basically February, I think it's adding a lot of stress for families in the sense of, am I going to hear back in time to make an informed decision for our family about the financial situation, and what's, you know, what are the colleges going to do that? When are they going to get information back to us? So I think it's just added, you know, finances is already a stressful thing for families, and this has just added a whole nother level. So
what are the main objectives behind this redesign of FAFSA?
I think it's supposed to increase access, so offering more access for the Pell Grant and offering more opportunities for families to receive. They've updated the amount, you know, they haven't updated the cost of living information in decades, and so this is supposed to offer opportunity for more families to gain federal aid.
Yeah, there has been some reports nationally that, you know, it's kind of been a bumpy rollout. I mean, have you experienced that at Christian Brothers?
100%. We've had families that are like, I can't get in. I keep trying. And Jackie and I were talking this morning about the window that was open and what's, you know, what's happening with that and just the kind of trying and failing multiple times over the last week to be able to get into the system and start filling stuff out and logging in and then not being able to log back in once logged out. So it's has been a roller coaster for the past couple of weeks, for sure.
Jackie, how has it been for you at Sac City?
You know, similar, you know, right now Sac City is still off, you know, for our break. But I know that our students and our families have already been working on this. We're very fortunate in that today is the first day that the FAFSA is going to be open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. That's going to be the case for tomorrow as well. So they have, during that soft launch, not had such extended periods of opening and availability. So that's really, I think, going to, you know, help out a lot. Additionally, for, you know, our students is we've really done a lot of backwards mapping and helping them to get their FSA ID, because that's one of the things that can, you know, sometimes take a few days, especially this year. It's new where families that where a parent may not have a Social Security number, they're still required to have an FSA ID. And so we've had to do some backwards mapping to make sure we're communicating that to our families. And as soon as the FAFSA opened, you know, helping them to know they can go ahead and start contacting studentaid.gov to be able to get their FSA ID completed, because that's really, you know, that's one of the first and foremost pieces that our students and families need to be doing, you know, to make sure that they can, you know, complete that contributor section. And that's a new terminology. It used to be parents and students, and, you know, but now this, everyone's called contributors. And so it may vary based on who's going to be the contributor, based on a marital status and such like that. So that's some things that we've been communicating, you know, way back in the fall. So that way, even before, you know, our parents and families went out for the holidays, they were aware of that.
Yeah, as Melissa mentioned, you know, the intention of this is to, like, increase eligibility, right? So especially, I would imagine, for low and middle income students and their families. You know, what have you learned about this new formula, you know, the student aid index, and how it will hopefully contribute to this goal?
Well, I know the intention behind some of the redesign is to increase Pell eligibility. So that way, you know, more people will be provided with Pell funding, as well as having more, you know, Pell money. So I think that those are part of the things to take into consideration. You know, one of the things to understand about the what used to be the EFC, the expected family contribution, now the student aid index, the SAI, is a lot of that's going to be determined on the college, right? So they're going to take that in the SAI, and then they're going to calculate that into their own formulas, you know, with what, you know, monies that they may have, you know, like you look at the UCs and they have the blue and gold, you know, so there are different funding sources that colleges have that they use to then provide a financial aid package. And so that's something that, you know, really is a unique quality of every single school. And so it's really pertinent for our students to make sure they're creating their portals, their student portals into all the colleges that they have, you know, intention to, you know, to pursue. So that way they make sure they're seeing what any of their financial aid to-dos are and following up, because it is not a mirror image from campus to campus.
Yeah, and that can make it even more difficult. I mean, as you mentioned, Melissa, you know, one of the biggest issues are these delays, right, happening. I mean, if you're a parent or a guardian, just a student, and you're concerned that this may actually impact how much you receive in financial aid, what advice do you have for students?
Best advice is always to contact the universities that a student is applying to. Their financial aid departments, each different institution, their financial aid departments run independently of all the other institutions. And so if there's questions about a student's financial aid package, or there's a need to create an appeal because what the FAFSA does is use prior taxes, so 2 years ago taxes. So a lot has happened. Families or pandemics or separations or job losses or deaths and all kinds of things can impact a family's ability to contribute to their student's first year of college. And so we always recommend contact the financial aid office directly for the school that the student is applying to. And that and may end up being a lot of legwork if a student's applying to 4, 5, 8, 10 different colleges, because, like Jackie mentioned, they all kind of do something different when they're calculating what type of aid that they're going to offer for a student. Is there merit institutional aid versus the federal aid? And so it can be a lot of legwork, but they're the ones that are making those decisions and are going to have the best information.
Yeah, I just think about, like, that is so much work on top of, you know, you only have 24 hours in a day. Everyone has different life, you know, responsibilities. You know, there are students who are contributing to their family's household income. You have parents that are working multiple jobs. I mean, that's a lot to deal with. I mean, what are you hearing from families about, you know, kind of, you know, wanting to get the most financial aid that they can, but also maybe potentially they might be missing out because they don't have the time and the bandwidth to sift through all of this?
I would think that, you know, one of the things that in this lull time, I would really just encourage our students and our families to be pursuing scholarships, right? Because, you know, now is a time when if maybe you couldn't get all of your information in or you're waiting to hear back, don't let this, you know, time go to waste. You know, make sure you're, if you haven't completed a letter, you know, request a letters of recommendation, do so. Complete those scholarships. Also, there's a nonprofit program called Decide Ed. It's an app through MoneyThink that once you do get your financial aid award letters, you can have those financial aid award letters uploaded into this algorithm, and it'll help parents to be able to make the decision, you know, to see which really is the best situation. Also, using the NET calculators that are available on all campuses' websites. And as of this year, it's mandatory that all school campuses have on their website special circumstances. So very much what Melissa was talking about, if there have been some changes in your family's history, financial history, or, you know, demographics, that making sure you're reaching out to your school to explain what my FAFSA or my California Dream Act may be reflecting is not actually accurate for this moment in time. Mm.
If you're already in college, do you have to apply for this every year?
Yes.
Correct.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. So, yeah. So even if you're like, oh, I'm good. No, there's changes this year. If you're like a sophomore.
Per year. You have to fill it out every year. Yes.
But your FSA ID is still going to be good. So if for parents and for students, you know, who maybe, you know, the students are in college, they don't have to get a new FSA ID. Parents who already have done that, completed or created their FSA ID for that student. Now they have a senior, they can use the same FSA ID. So some things, have stayed the same. So that's nice.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we are discussing all things about the changes to college financial aid. Now I want to talk with John Waldrip because you are the analyst and trainer for the California Student Aid Commission, and your expertise is the Cal Grant program. So who is it designed for and who's eligible?
Well, the Cal Grant program is designed for virtually every student in California. So by applying with the FAFSA or the California Dream Act, I always say those are one-stop shopping for most financial aid that you can get, including the Cal Grant. Cal Grants are free money for college. You don't have to pay them back. They are available at virtually every college and university. And the California Student Aid Commission gives out approximately $3 billion a year in financial aid, mostly Cal Grants.
And so obviously FAFSA is federal, Cal Grant is state. Are there changes to Cal Grant like what FAFSA is incurring right now?
Well, FAFSA is the application, and Cal Grant is the scholarship. So those are two different things. Sometimes people say, oh, I got my FAFSA money. Well, it's like, no, you just applied with the FAFSA. FAFSA is the application, and the DREAM Act application for undocumented students is the application. And that's what makes them eligible for Cal Grant consideration.
Hmm. With the California DREAM Act application, there have been some recent revisions, right? What are the most notable ones that people should know about?
Yeah, so the application, because the FAFSA changed so radically, we did make some changes to the California DREAM Act application. We've done a couple different things. One of the things that we did was we embedded the affidavit that students are required to complete. So that's now embedded into the application. It's not a separate process any longer. We also streamlined some of the questions to make them easier to understand. We updated the parent signature portion so that it was not as clunky as it had been in previous iterations. So we've made some changes.
When it comes to students who are undocumented, I mean, how does this legal affidavit affect these students and these families?
Well, so in the past, if students, undocumented students can fill out the California DREAM Act application. California is by far the leader in offering aid and assistance to undocumented students. So, and the California DREAM Act application is proprietary to the state of California. So when they filled that out in the past, filling out the affidavit, which was something they were required to do, was a separate process. And a lot of students didn't know that existed, and it became incumbent upon the colleges and universities to contact those students and let them know. And unfortunately, a lot of students weren't paid financial aid because they hadn't completed that affidavit.
Oh, wow. I would just imagine there's just a lot of mixed messages that the families are receiving about, what kind of aid they're eligible for. And then I would also think when it comes to the DREAM Act application, there may be some hesitation to share your information. I mean, the DREAM Act application is not shared with the federal government or immigration authorities, but there's also outreach and messaging that needs to be done to ensure that families know that, right?
Yeah, no, we are working on that. We do a number of workshops. We get in front of 15,000, high school counselors, and we share that information. So the information on the DREAM Act application is only for financial aid purposes. That's strictly what it's used for. And we want to encourage students, undocumented students, to complete it and find out about it. And sadly, a lot of students either don't know it exists, or because everything is so political, they're fearful. And I think our messaging is, fill out the application, yes, go to college. That's always going to be the better alternative.
A recent number that we found was that I believe 14% of the state's nearly 100,000 undocumented college students receive state financial aid. And this was for the 2021-2022 school year. 14%. I mean, is that a low number?
That is a low number.
Yes. Okay.
We can do better. And so part of the problem is students don't know that aid's available. Part of the problem is some students don't meet the AB 540 criteria because they've only been in the state for a year. But it's been expanded, so a lot of students now have opportunities. And some students don't have the support they need to, find and complete the application. A lot of these are first-generation students, and their families are just not familiar with the process. But the Student Aid Commission offers thousands of Cash for College events and other events, and there are lots of organizations in the states that are willing to help.
On the higher education end, you know, how can schools, colleges, you know, universities, you know, do a better part, maybe facilitate the process for students submitting this required paperwork?
Well, so now it's going to be part of the application, and that means that universities and colleges have the opportunity to, they'll be provided that information directly via the information that's provided from the application. So if they choose to use that, and we're hoping that they do, that eliminates that step for the student. You know, otherwise, we just have to let students know that this is something they need to do in order to get paid, and schools need to communicate that.
Jackie, when it comes to the DREAM Act, and there are undocumented students at Sac City Unified, as well as lots of schools, I would imagine Melissa's as well, but how do you help families and students know that it's actually available, that they're actually eligible?
Well, I think one of the first and foremost things is we say FAFSA and the California DREAM Act in the same sentence, right? Because it's so important for the inclusivity. As we're doing our Cash for College events, you know, we make sure that we have sections designated for, you know, language support services. We have experts in the room that are, you know, understanding, you know, the nuances of should a family complete a financial a FAFSA or should they complete a California DREAM Act. We also in our district use the state's college and career planning platform, californiacolleges.edu. And so that's available for our students to go in starting in sixth grade. They can start to go in and start understanding financial aid. We actively in seventh grade start using it and helping to have our families understand the importance of completing these financial aid applications. You know, the looking at the securities that, you know, are being taken with the personal identifying information, and then also just making it very personalized. You know, so there is legislation that was passed for 2022, AB 469, which requires all seniors to have completed either the FAFSA, the California DREAM Act, or a waiver. And so that's part of the information that we're sharing with our families is, you know, backwards mapping that, you know, way early on to help them to understand, mm-hmm. you know, the importance of the financial aid applications, the security around those, and, you know, helping them again to future cast the you know, their child's, you know, college world and you know, not be so scared.
Finally, I mean, we're talking about a topic that for, I think, the majority of people feels like a headache. It feels like a different language. You know, it feels like going back to school to figure out financial aid. It's not really necessarily a fun thing to look forward to. With the three of you, just immerse yourself in it. You know, this is what you do day in and day out. Why do you love doing it, Melissa?
It really is just wonderful when, you know, a student walks into my office and can say, I got into my dream school and we can afford it and it's going to work out. And oftentimes they'll come back the Christmas after their freshman year and come in and say how, you know, wonderful college is. And they light up talking about what a wonderful experience they have. So that's just, it's so rewarding and it's so fun to see when it all works out. There's definitely tears sometimes when it doesn't. And we work through and look to find, you know, other ways and other options. But it is rewarding to see when it all works out.
How about you, Jackie?
Well, you know, my father was a foster youth. And so it's really important for me to be able to, you know, embrace, you know, all the diversity that we have and help our families to be able to see that, you know, college is attainable. As I said, I was first generation. You know, my mom didn't graduate high school. And just to be able to I wish I'd had the support that I want to provide to others. And because, you know, education is something that once, you know, it's in your power, it can't be taken away. And I really just, you know, whether it is our students, you know, 4-year, but certificates, going to get, you know, the certificate of the community college, there's some really great high-paying jobs, web developer, building inspector, you know, that they need to have completed their FAFSA or the California DREAM Act to be able to get that free tuition for the community college. So I think for me, it's communication and education to, you know, have the future that they deserve.
How about you, John?
Well, I mean, I'm a trainer with the Student Aid Commission, and so we get out and get in front of students and educators. And there's nothing more tangible than helping a family complete an application, right? There's nothing more tangible than sitting with that family, walking them through the process, and seeing that the student's going to get financial aid. And it's great. And sometimes that's a first-generation student. Sometimes that's an undocumented student. And I love that feeling, and I love doing something that I think is going to help that family.
Well, John, Jackie, and Melissa, thank you so much for the conversation and your passion for financial aid.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Melissa McClellan is the Director of College Counseling at Christian Brothers High School. Jackie Navarez is the College and Career Coordinator for the Sacramento City Unified School District. And John Waldrip is an analyst and trainer at the California Student Aid Commission. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. For those who enjoy the Christmas spirit over the holidays, the star of the tradition is usually a tree, whether a fir, spruce, or pine. Getting the tree is usually an exciting time. It sets into motion this festive anticipation until Christmas Day, but usually the 26th sets into motion an expiration date. Now, it's up for debate, but generally Christmas trees and lights usually stay up until January 6th. That's this weekend, 12 days after Christmas. And you may be wondering what to do with your tree, how to get rid of it. Well, you can recycle it for free, but the rules vary from one city or county to the next. CAP Radio environment reporter Manolo Sakaida joins us with some advice on how to recycle a Christmas tree. And while we're on the theme of organic waste, Manolo also has an update on California's composting mandate that went into effect a year ago. This year brings a change to composting. Residents can be fined for not complying with the mandatory composting requirement, but that option is up to local officials. Hey, Manola.
Hey, Vicki.
Okay, so let's just get to the Christmas trees. You know, when you want to recycle or compost it, what should residents do with their trees?
Yeah, so most cities have different services that they offer. In the city of Sacramento, if you're a leaf season recipient of that leaf season service,
the big claw,
then you can get your trees picked up by just leaving them on your leaf pile. So it's pretty simple. But like I mentioned, it kind of varies. And there's also different restrictions that vary from city to city. So, for example, in the city of Sacramento, you can recycle flocked trees, which I learned is the term for those trees that have the fake snow sprayed all over them.
Yeah.
Those trees can be recycled in the city of Sacramento. But in other places like West Sacramento, you can't recycle those trees. I'm assuming it's just different technology to handle them. So it really depends on where you are. And the number one thing that you should do if you want to recycle your tree is just look up the requirements based on where you live, because there's just so much variation. But likely your city offers something is what I can say.
Right. Well, there's also like a new change last year was really like composting, and that, you know, California, this was in 2022, but last year was the first full year it implemented these new requirements for recycling organic waste. That also includes our areas like Sacramento. So remind us about the intention behind the mandate and what the intended goals are.
Right. So the basic timeline, like you mentioned, is that in 2022, California's mandate requiring residents to recycle organic waste, which we then turn into compost, went into effect. And then last year was the first full year of that law being implemented. And when California originally passed that law, we were the first in the country to pass a statewide mandate to separate organic food waste from other trash. So it was a pretty big deal. And it also required most cities in the state to start this composting program on a pretty short timeline. So that meant figuring out how to, you know, gather that organic waste and then also how to scale up our facilities to process all that new composting material. So It's been a complicated process for a lot of places. And then the goal of this mandate is to be part of California's climate goals in general. So, you know, reducing the methane that comes from rotting food in landfills. It's a powerful greenhouse gas. And the law hopes to curb those emissions and reduce food waste in landfills by 75% within the first 2 years, which we're kind of approaching at this point.
I would imagine there's like a big learning curve to this, you know, for myself included. I mean, even like in our newsroom, like we have the different bins and there's like a sign like this stuff goes in this bin and this stuff goes in this bin. So what's happened in, you know, the year plus since this actually has been enacted?
Exactly. It's not super intuitive for everyone, especially if you haven't lived in a place where this is required or you haven't, you know, been interested in doing this before. So what city officials have done is mostly focus on education. You know, like you mentioned at the beginning, in this year, in 2024, California municipalities will have the option to fine residents who aren't complying with this mandate. But from all the local officials I talked to, it seems like the priority is education, and it's likely to stay that way for the foreseeable future. One person I talked to was Matt Robinson, who's a spokesperson for Sacramento County. They collect organic waste from anyone living in unincorporated areas. And he told me what many of the other people told me that I talked to for this story, which is that he doesn't have any plans to implement fines. They don't have a framework even of what that would look like, because right now he feels like the most effective way of getting people on board is education. And that just means, you know, getting people to know how to use their bin, how to use it in ways that aren't a nuisance. But yeah, it doesn't seem like fining is where they want to go with that right now.
Because essentially, it's like a third bin, right? Because you have one for recycling, you have one obviously for waste, and then you have one that would go into composting.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and that might seem straightforward, but there's some issues that people have with that inevitably. And it seems pretty straightforward from one person that I spoke to. Her name is Marissa Jeweler, the director of the Integrated Waste Management Division at the Yolo County Central Landfill. Kind of a mouthful. She toured me around the facility, and I got to see the whole process of how they compost. And, you know, of course, there are things that people may have accidentally put in there or have gotten in their bin for some other way, like she mentioned finding shoes and toys. But that's not even the main issue. So if you're listening to this and wondering, oh no, like if I'm putting eggshells in and I'm not sure if that's supposed to be in, is that going to get me in trouble later? I really don't think that's what people are focusing on right now. What Marissa told me is that there are a lot of people that just aren't participating in the program at all. So that doesn't mean even doing anything incorrectly, but that just means people who aren't using their green bins.
They're still throwing it all in the trash. And so I could be wrong for other counties, but I would say that we're just kind of in this infancy stage where folks are still just not on board.
And there's a variety of reasons for why someone might not be participating. And she told me her priority is to understand why and then, you know, try to meet people where they're at. So as one example, she told me about a resident who she met with who was not using her green bin at all. And the resident told her, you know, in the summer, I've tried and it attracts all these bugs and I just don't want that to be, you know, happening. I don't want that around my house. And so she told this resident, why not start by just doing it during the colder months? And the resident hadn't really thought of that as being an option. And after, you know, they discussed what that could look like, she said, sure, I'd give it a shot. And that's really what it's about for people like Marissa. It's not trying to be, you know, getting people to do this perfectly right away necessarily. I mean, if you can, that's great. But it's just getting people to start participating and see in action, you know, what this looks like and try to figure out the issues from there. And then there's another part that can get kind of difficult, and it's not even about the consumer. You know, when I looked at the facility when I was with Marissa, I saw that the composting process takes about 3 months. It's actually sped up because of all the technology they use at the facility. And that timeline works for things like food scraps, but it actually might not work for what we call, you know, compostable utensils and containers.
There are a lot of misconceptions about like biodegradable cups and plates and cutlery that while they claim to be green, it will come out of this process as a residual and end up back in a landfill. Because if you read the fine print, it takes 3 to 5 years for it to break down. This process is not even 90 days. And so we're really trying to change the dialogue about the importance of using paper products.
So it's complicated. You know, on the one hand, we want more people to participate. And on the other, we're still figuring out how to do this composting, you know, in the first place at the scale that we are committed to.
Yeah, it seems like there's like a disconnect behind labeling, you know, and advertising what something is used for, and then it actually, you know, the reality of it. In the last like 30 seconds or so we have, you know, how are officials tracking composting habits and amounts?
Yeah, so it's kind of difficult. I talked to Jessa David, who's a spokesperson for the city of Sacramento, and she said right now they don't really have an exact measurement of how much people are putting in their bins. You know, precipitation from like rain can add weight to, you know, someone's compost, someone's organic waste, and make it so that we don't really know exactly how much is what. But she did say that from some early assessments in 2022, they found an increase of 14% in organics tonnage being collected and a 10% decrease in garbage collected. So she didn't want to say for sure that's what it meant, but it might be an indication that we are seeing a bit of a shift.
Hopefully we're heading in the right direction. Thanks, yes. Manola. That is CAP Radio Environment reporter Manola Sakaita updating us on a state composting mandate that went into effect a year ago. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. And if you want to email us, we're located at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.